history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some incredible stories to be told, seemingly ordinary Americans who went through extraordinary things, and we want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom, and along the way, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're always entertained, and often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. I know that's going to be the case today here in South Bend, Indiana. And we're not talking Notre Dame football, although I guess we could, but we're talking to...
Not this year.
Yeah, not with a 4-8 season for Brian Kelly. He's not the mayor of South Bend anymore, but some might say Paul Davis deserves that title. He's lived here his entire life. He's still very involved in the community. He's 2 days a week pushing wheelchairs at Memorial Hospital. That's how he stays in such great shape. Is that your secret to setting world records for the oldest guy to zip line in Hawaii, or what
well,
is it?
I'm very thankful that I can do what I do today.
Well, in 70-some years ago, it was a little different story what you were dealing with. We're going to hear about your experiences in Europe during World War II. But tell me about growing up here in South Bend. Were you following Newt Rockne's teams or what?
Yes, and I didn't get to too many of my high school games or anything because I worked.
How old were you when you started working?
Probably about 10 years old. I started with my little red wagon. We went out and sold radishes and onions and stuff. Then I went to selling magazines, Saturday Evening Post and the Ladies' Home Journal. And then when I was 16, I started working for Western Union. And I worked 5 nights a week for Western Union from 4 to 10 o'clock and on holidays and stuff.
While you're going to high school?
Right, my last 2 years of high school. One of my favorite things now, when I worked for Western Union, was they had singing telegrams, and I always was able to work my way out of it. But one night I was there by myself, and I had no choice, and I had to take a singing telegram out to Ernestine Morris. Her father was the originator of the Associates Investment Company and First Bank. And I was scared to death. And I went out their big house on Jefferson Boulevard, and I went up to the front door and knocked. There's all these people in tuxes and real fancy gowns and stuff. And I made a big fool of myself. But I got a $5 tip, and I was making $12 a week.
Wow, that's a big
tip. And it was a very good tip. Well, after that, I never turned down a singing telegram, but I never got a tip either.
Well, I'm hoping you'll play the organ for me later, so maybe that
yes.
will trump the singing. And somewhere along the line in those teenage years, you ran across a young lady named Beverly. How did you
right.
two meet?
I met her. She was going with my best boyfriend. And
naturally.
He didn't get along with my father-in-law. One night, we used to have these cherry bombs that they would put out in the street when they were working on them and stuff. And he put one on my in-law's front porch.
They weren't your in-laws yet, of course, just
no.
so everyone doesn't get confused out there.
So,
your future in-law's porch, so he wasn't going to be the future son-in-law.
That's right.
Uh-huh.
That ended Johnny, and my father-in-law came home and found that, and he called him. Well, he says, I was with my father all evening. Well, that ended Johnny, so then I started going with her.
You seized the opportunity, huh?
Right. She was an only child, so I got along very good with my father-in-law. He was the one that got me interested in masonry.
Aha. Uh-huh. And now you're the first one in your lodge with a 50-year pin.
50-year past master's pin, being the head of the lodge.
But none of that was on your mind when you're going to school.
No.
And something happened your senior year in high school that changed the world a little bit. Do you remember December 7th, 1941?
Yes, I do. I was working that night delivering telegrams.
So how did you find out?
We got some telegrams that was stating it. Back then, you didn't have any TV or anything, or just radio.
So you had to deliver telegrams that said Pearl Harbor has been bombed?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Did you know where Pearl Harbor was?
No. I had no idea.
When did it register what had happened and what the gravity of that was?
The next day when the paper came out and had pictures of it and everything.
Then you said, hey, this is what I was delivering news about last
right.
night, huh?
Yeah.
And what about dreams and ambitions? I mean, it's clear that you were a guy who took initiative. I mean, you're out there selling things from the age of 10 to make money. But did you have a dream or an idea of once I grow up, I'm going to do this?
Well, yes. I had more things that I learned from my father not to do than what to do. I always said that if I have kids, they wouldn't go through what I went through as a kid. I had four brothers and a sister. We lived in a little two-room house. It had an outside toilet, but it had water to it. But in the wintertime, we had to shut the water off. So when we would go out at night, we would take a bucket of water with us in one hand and the Sears Roebuck catalog in the other hand.
Mm-hmm.
And believe me, they'd scratch.
Yeah, I believe it. And I've heard of that use for that catalog before.
And when you got to the glossy pages, those were rough.
Yikes. So you endured that. You persevered through it, but you told yourself the next generation's not going to deal with this.
Right.
How soon after Pearl Harbor did it occur to you that this was something that you might have to get involved in?
Well, when they started putting the 18-year-old draft in.
Because you were 17 at the time of Pearl Harbor.
Right.
And turned 18 the next June.
Right. Well, the draft started for me in January. I got my letter 1 week. I got my classification the next week. I got my physical the next week. And the next week I was in the Army.
Did you have an expectation of what Army life was going to be like?
Had no idea, but I soon found out. I grew up in a hurry.
Where'd they send you?
Well, I went to Texas. It was Red River Ordnance, and I was there 6 months for training, and they sent me out to Oregon to school, and when I got out there, there was no school.
So oops.
I was out there 3 weeks and came back, and then we transferred to Camp Gruber, Oklahoma, for another 6 months, and then we went to England. We were in England 6 months.
What kind of specialized training were you getting in Oklahoma?
Field artillery maintenance was what I was in. We went up to as big as a 155-millimeter gun.
So you had to know how to take apart and fix several different artillery pieces.
Yes, and we had so many rounds they had to change the barrel, and that was our job to change it. And then we'd take it back up to the front line, and we had to fire the first shot to make sure we did our job right.
Mm-hmm. So you learn how to do all that in Oklahoma, and then you mentioned you spent 6 months in England, but what about that journey to England? Had you ever been on a ship before?
Not like that, and we were in a convoy. It was in January, and we hit a storm in the Atlantic. I was on a little boat similar to a Liberty ship, but it wasn't a Liberty ship, and we hit a storm in the Atlantic, and we were in convoy, and we were behind an aircraft carrier. And the aircraft carrier was rocking, and you swear that the back end of that aircraft carrier was going to come down on the bow of our boat, but it didn't. We made it. It took us 14 days to get to England.
Yeah, sounds like a nervous couple weeks there.
Right.
Not to mention the threat of German submarines.
Right, but what I did, see, going over there, the Army only got 2 meals a day.
Right.
So I volunteered with the Navy to work in the mess hall. So I got 3 meals a day.
You seem like the kind of guy who's always been a step ahead of most of the rest of us.
Well, I try to keep up.
So you mentioned 6 months in England.
Yes.
Same kind of thing? Tending to artillery?
Yes. We were in field artillery maintenance. That was my section that I was in. We serviced anything from a .45 caliber to a .155 gun.
Well, that's a pretty wide range.
Yes. We had an automotive section, artillery section, small instrument section, and so we had everything covered.
So you were Mr. Fix-It.
Right, and we were there 6 months.
And Beverly was writing you letters?
Yes, we had V-mail back then.
Yeah.
It was a little letters, and we never got to see London. So when we hit Omaha Beachhead, we said, come hell or high water, we're going to see Paris. So we were about 35 miles south of Paris at Fontainebleau. One day, half of us went AWOL, went to Paris. Second day, the rest of us went, and that was quite an experience. We went in the Jeep that had Beverly's name on it,
mm-hmm.
And there was four of us. We got into Paris. It was an open city. We wasn't supposed to be there, but we were there, and we met these two French girls that could speak English. And they took us around to the Eiffel Tower and Notre Dame Cathedral and the Arc of Triumph and stuff. those people had never seen a Jeep or anything before. So what we would do, one of the gals and two of us would go up in the Eiffel Tower, come down, and the other two would go. And then come down and be surrounded by people.
Somebody had to guard the Jeep.
Right.
And the Jeep had a big crowd around it. Huh?
Right. We got to see Paris, and as soon as it started to get dark, well, the snipers started shooting, so we got out of there in a hurry.
I would think so, yeah. So that was early on after you got over there? Is that what you're saying?
Right.
France is still being fought for at this time.
Right.
Yeah, so that was a little foolhardy of you guys to do that.
Right.
Could have gotten yourselves killed.
If we got caught, we could have served a life sentence for going AWOL, too.
Yeah, but you got away with it.
Right. Back then, you didn't know from one day to the next what was going to happen to you.
And you mentioned coming ashore at Omaha Beach. You did that 10 days after the invasion.
Yes.
But I'm curious about that. So here you've been training in England for 6 months. Did you hear about the invasion when it happened?
Yes. We were supposed to go in on the initial invasion, but that's the one thing that we've praised our commander for. He did not get us our waterproofing for the vehicles, so mm-hmm. we couldn't go. So there was another outfit that was ready and took our place. And, they didn't make it. They got stuck in the channel. So we were very fortunate there.
Yeah. When did you find that out? What happened to them?
When we got into France. They were in about 5 miles when we landed. First night, they told us to dig foxholes. Well, we thought, what do we need a foxhole for? And about 11 o'clock at night, bedcheck Charlie came over, and he hit an ammunition dump on one side of us and a fuel dump on the other side of us. And so they didn't tell us after that. We had these little bitty shovels, but we always dug a foxhole after that.
And for people who don't know what bedcheck Charlie is, that's a German bomber that would come over about the same time every night.
Yes.
So he hit an ammunition dump. That sent off some fireworks and got your attention a little bit.
Right, it sure did.
Maybe he was just trying to say happy birthday.
I don't know what he was trying to say, but he taught us a lesson in a hurry.
But that was your 20th birthday, the day you came ashore on Omaha Beach.
Yes, that was that first night.
That had to be a little surreal.
Yeah.
Because you had heard about what had happened there, and then I'm sure you saw some of the aftermath of the fighting, right?
Right.
Was that kind of intimidating? Or
yes, it was. Mm-hmm.
So you learned about the foxholes, and then you find out, hey, those guys that went in our place,
they're down in the channel.
How did you swallow that?
I thank God I made it.
Yeah. Wow. And I'm sure that's not the only twist like that that spared your life the way. What was the first... Well, you talked about bed check, Charlie. What was the next indication you got of how serious this thing called war could be?
Well, you never knew what to expect. Just like when we were in the Battle of the Bulge, we figured that was it because we were surrounded.
That would be about 6 months after you landed there.
Yes.
What were you doing for those 6 months?
Well, we were repairing guns and vehicles and stuff.
Typically, where were you in relation to the front?
Normally, I'd say we were probably anywhere from 5 to 10 miles
right.
from the actual front. The only time we were actually on the front was when we took the guns up, set them up, and fired the first shot.
Right. And how often would you have to replace a barrel on a gun?
There were so many rounds, and depended upon the size of the gun. The bigger the barrel, the less number of rounds that could be shot through it.
Uh-huh. But because there's so many different guns, you guys are probably kept pretty busy.
Right. We service guns on tanks, too.
Mm-hmm. And how'd you pull your own Jeep?
Well, I was a driver for a second lieutenant. That's how I got my own Jeep.
And he let you put your girl's name on it?
Yes.
Did you send her a picture of that?
Oh, yeah. Well, she was tickled to death to think that I put her name on it. And we had two Jeeps in our outfit when we left England. And then as we were going through, we would get wrecked or bombed Jeeps or something, we would cannibalize them. So when the war ended, we had 11 Jeeps, and they have a W number on them, and we had six of them with one W number on them and five with another W number on them.
The Franken Jeeps, huh?
Yep.
Pieced together. Well, you mentioned, you know, that realization that the guys who went over when you could have been going over, that they didn't make it. Did you get to a point where you had to deal with losing somebody that you had gotten to know pretty well?
Oh, yes. Yeah. But we were very fortunate we didn't lose very many. because we were not actually on the line a lot.
Right. How did you deal with that? Because, I can't think of anything that would prepare you for that. You're a 20-year-old kid half a world away from home.
No, you grow up in a hurry and learn respect.
I know this sounds like a dumb question, but I've got to ask it anyway. Were you scared? Were you afraid that you might not come home?
Yes.
Yep. Well, and I know you had some good reasons to be, and we want to hear some of those examples, but it's time for our first break, so we'll get to those close calls when we come back. You'll find photos and videos of Mr. Davis at hometownheroesradio.com and the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook, and we'll be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country, and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.